Good morning. You're listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
Good morning. This is Debbie Verney.
Good morning. This is Dave Kubikin.
And we're two of the attorneys at the Herzog Law Firm. We're going to be here for the next hour to talk to you about estate planning, estate administration, Medicaid planning, and you could be our very first caller on this lovely, sunny, not so much morning at 518-476-5900. That's 518-476-5900 or toll free at 1-800-WROW-590. That's 1-800-WROW-590. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning, Debbie. How are you?
Good. Good. It's good Saturday, right?
Listen, if nobody calls at all, that's fine. We'll catch up because we barely see each other. We'll talk for an hour.
Which is good. Busy is good.
Busy is good. Well, there's good busy and bad busy.
So I know that you're like dying to talk about probate this morning.
I am. But before I do that, I wanted to wish a very happy birthday on Monday to Dr. Dre. Dr. Dre is going to be 54 years old. I don't know if you, Ben, did you know that?
I did not know he was 54.
And
I know who Dr. Dre
is.
Some
of our listeners who Dr. Dre is.
Well, he's one of the founding members of a rap group called NWA. And he then made more money than you can count through headphones, the Beats by Dre headphones that Apple bought. And a happy 47th belated birthday to Billy Joe Armstrong from Green Day. Green Day, yes.
Yeah. I know who Green Day is. Ben and I are like, we're old, but we're not that old, right?
We're not that old.
Well,
no.
Well, guess what? They're getting old. I can't believe. I couldn't believe that
we all
that,
are, Dave.
That, that this, you know, Dr. Dre's 54, the founder of Green Day is 47. I'm getting old. That's what that all means.
Yeah, I thought you were gonna like wish happy birthday to your wife, your in-laws, your outlaws, something
your child.
Like that. Your child, yeah, and instead it's,
well,
yeah.
If my wife had the same birthday as Dr. Dre, I would have.
Good to know.
Good to know. He's born on President's Day.
Okay, so we birthday, really Dre. Do need some callers to call in at 518.
Well, so just so everyone, there's a calendar in the room that has all these important dates and in music history and when people were born or when certain albums or hits hit number one, so I like to look before we start.
And keep us up to date.
Yeah, why not?
Nothing wrong. It's your fault, Ben. You gave him time to look at the calendar.
I can't help it. He came in 10 minutes early.
Okay. So now we know. We need to hide the calendar whenever Dave's coming in.
Well, so I did want to talk about probate because Debbie, you, myself, Jane Marie, we deal a lot with estate administration, whether someone has a will or not, whether it's a probate proving of the will or whether they don't have a will and it's still an administration. And it's not a very fun process. It's a necessary evil that we do. It requires a lot of attorney time and a lot of paralegal time. And unfortunately, that means a lot of legal fees. But it is usually entirely avoidable. And so I wanted to walk people through how bad it can be and how easy it is to try to avoid. Because I think, Debbie, we always spend so much time focusing on the long-term care planning and the Medicaid trusts that we sometimes lose sight of the real basics, who gets what, and let's make sure we avoid probate because it really is that bad. Let's do revocable trust. Let's be smart about our beneficiary designations and things like that.
It is. It's one of those things where people kind of forget about that, and people forget to change their beneficiaries.
Oh, yeah.
And that's kind of been huge here lately where you have a situation where mom and dad named each other as beneficiaries on their life insurance, on their retirement accounts, on everything, and they didn't name contingent beneficiaries, meaning someone that would take if they didn't. Dave's like looking up and
I hear the air conditioning on the microphone, so I don't know if anyone else hears it, but
that's interesting. Anyway, back to what I was talking about.
Yes.
Anyway,
beneficiaries.
So they don't change their beneficiaries. So dad passes away, everything goes to mom. Mom never changes her beneficiaries. It's payable to dad when she dies. And now we have to probate the estate just to be able to get the life insurance, just to be able to get the retirement accounts. And that could have been solved so easily.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when someone passes away, and sorry to start talking about this at 8:10 in the morning, but you're listening, so I'm going to talk about it. When someone passes away, their assets are going to go to different people, either because, as you mentioned, they have beneficiaries like life insurance, or it's going to be that they had joint assets with a spouse or with a child where there's rights of survivorship. So that asset will pass to the survivor. And that's great when it works, when the money is used by the person who gets it, and I'll tell you what I mean in a second. But if we have a house where we don't have it jointly owned with rights of survivorship, if we have a bank account that didn't have a pay on death to, transfer on death to person, forever and ever, no one will be able to access that money. No one will be able to sell that house unless they go through an estate administration with the surrogate's court. And when there's a will, we call it probate. When there's no will, it's technically just an estate administration. But we kind of use probate like most people use the word Band-Aid, which is an estate administration.
Exactly.
When we say probate. And your will say who gets what if you have a will. If you don't have a will, the state in New York will say who gets what. But the way it all happens, the process of going from a piece of paper that says will when someone passed away to actually having money go to all the people that the will says, that's this probate, estate administration we're talking about. And it is very lengthy and it's very expensive. And we deal with a lot of them. And even when they're really simple fact patterns, everything goes to kids.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long, the steps are, we still need to take all the steps, even though there's not going to be a will contest and everyone agrees on who gets the money. It still takes a very long time. I have a couple messy ones, and that's why this is on my mind, because we have to do these accountings. And when people don't agree, and sometimes siblings don't agree after mom and dad pass away, the one thing that connected them is now gone. And now, well, you never let me play on your basketball team, and you did this, and you did that, and that all comes out. It can be very difficult to conclude an estate, right? Instead of a piece of paper, an informal accounting that says, all right, here's the math, this is what came in, you get this, I get this, deal. It can be court involved, right? Court supervised, and we'll submit a formal accounting. It takes hours and hours and hours to do, and we may be fighting over pennies, literally, after we're done with attorney's fees. And it's really unfortunate. And the seminars that we did this past week, wills versus trust, hopefully cleared up some of the myths about what an estate is and what trusts accomplish.
It's difficult to try to explain that to someone.
Yeah.
People's eyes tend to glaze over once you start talking about this. It's like, but I have a will. But you have to be specific. I had a situation where it was another attorney that did the will. It was a different law firm. And it was his uncle. And he did the estate plan for him. And the uncle had a son that he had adopted. But the son hadn't had anything to do with his dad for a long, long time. So when they were doing the will, they left him out. Right? So they didn't even mention his name.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just say his name was Eric. Right? So
was his name Eric?
His name wasn't Eric.
Okay.
But anyway, so uncle dies and Eric comes out of the woodwork and says, hey, you know, where's mine? That was my dad. Well, you can disinherit your children in New York. So it's like, guess what? You get nothing. So he decides he wants to take it to court. We end up going to court. And what happens when someone contests a will, they do what's called a 1404 hearing. And it's a hearing where they interview the drafting attorney and the witnesses to the will to make sure that the person knew what they were doing whenever they signed the will. So when they get the witnesses on the stand, the attorney for the other side says, so how do you know he didn't want to leave anything to Eric? And they said, well, whenever we were signing the will, we said to him, are you sure you don't want to leave anything to Eric? And he said, no, I don't want to leave anything to Eric. And the attorney says, did you say, are you sure you don't want to leave anything to your son, Eric? And they said, no, we just said Eric. He's like, well, Eric could have been anybody. So obviously, you know, yeah, I know. So it was like, you've got to be specific in your documents. A lot of times, if there's someone that they specifically want to make sure that they're not going to get anything, I put language in that says, you know, I have specifically made no bequest to Eric, not out of love or lack of love or affection for reasons best known to him. And that would have solved that situation. But they ended up having to settle because they didn't want to pay any more attorney fees. But, I mean, that's how specific they came in and said, did they say it was your son, Eric, as opposed to Eric? Eric could have been the neighborhood guy.
That's such a nightmare. I mean, I'm shaking my head because I could just see this hearing taking place. And for people that don't realize, if you have a will that says, I give everything to Ben, He's great on Saturday mornings.
Thank you.
That's what I'm leaving everything to Ben. Well, by law, my will, when in the process of getting it admitted to probate, I need to notify everyone that would have gotten my stuff if I didn't have a will leaving it to Ben. So in your fact pattern, adopted son, he is a distributee is the term, which means that he has the right to contest a will if he would have gotten more as a result of the will getting booted out of court, which is obviously the case.
Which he would, yeah.
And so he can ruffle feathers. And guess who pays for the 1404 hearing?
Yep.
It's the estate.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone gets less money. So it can get really messy, okay? And even when it's not messy, it's just time-consuming and expensive unnecessarily. And then, you know, siblings, they fight. It's unbelievable. I'm very thankful that, you know, my brother and I have a great relationship.
You do now.
You're right. And I know what you're saying because anything can happen.
Oh, yeah.
But if my parents plan accordingly, whether we get along or not won't have an impact on who gets what because maybe they'll use a revocable trust or something like that.
And we have a caller. We have Jim from New Scotland. Good morning, Jim. Is Jim there?
Jim?
Hey,
Jim.
I've transferred, my attorney told me to transfer all cash value life insurance policies into the trust because there's a significant amount of cash value.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now my insurance agent is saying that if I pay the premiums on those insurance policies, then that could nullify my Medicaid protection. Also, I have a brokerage account which I transferred to the irrevocable trust. And my broker now is saying he can't speak to me about the account anymore. And I said, wait a minute, this is a grantor trust, not a blind trust.
Right.
What do you make of that?
So when did your financial planner, when did they get their law degree?
No, this was my insurance agent.
Well, your insurance agent, when did he get...
And the brokerage agent saying, well, I can't talk to you anymore. I can only talk to your daughter and your son because they're the trustees.
Well, that's why we try to make sure that we work together with people's insurance agents and their financial planners. I mean, basically what happens when you transfer your cash value to your trust, you're still paying the premiums and it doesn't break the trust. As long as you're not paying the premiums out of the trust, the money should be paid out of your individual account. So that's not an issue. As far as your brokerage account goes, your broker should have a limited power of attorney I don't know what it's called. Isn't there a document? I can't think of the name of it. That you can sign and the trustee can sign that the trustee says, Dad can buy, sell, trade. He just can't write himself a check. So there's a piece of paper. All of the brokerage houses have them that can be signed by the trustee that says that you can talk to the broker, that you can buy, sell, trade. You just can't write yourself a check.
Okay, now, my insurance agent was telling me that the premiums have to be paid from the checking account that I set up for the trust. That's not correct, right?
There should not be. The checking account you have for the trust, what are you paying out of that checking account?
I haven't done anything with it yet. It's in the name of the trust with my daughter and son's signatures.
Okay. You shouldn't be writing checks out of the trust. What happens is when you do an irrevocable trust, and that's what you've got, right? An irrevocable grantor trust.
Yes.
The only way money that's principal comes out of the trust is if you do what's called a partial revocation.
Uh-huh.
So if you want to write checks out of the trust for interest, right? If there's interest or dividends, say you have it attached to your brokerage account, the kids could write you checks for that, but they can't write any checks for principal.
Okay. All right. Great. So let's say my annual dividends and capital gains out of the brokerage account is $12,000. They can't write any checks more than $12,000.
Well, you don't want to write your check for capital gains either. The capital gains would stay in the trust. So it would just be interest and dividends.
Interest and dividends. Oh, income. Strictly
mm-hmm.
income.
Strictly income.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Have a great weekend.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You know, Debbie, you can make an argument that when you're making payments from your own pocket to something that's in the trust, like an insurance policy, maybe each time that you're making that premium payment, you're adding value to the trust, and maybe that could be something that Medicaid looks at in a 5-year look-back period, but certainly it's not going to have anything to do with what was in the trust and what you put into the trust 5 years ago or whatever date you did. And that's even the best argument I could possibly even think of for some issue with paying premiums from outside. But that's what people will do, right? We want to take your existing cash value and protect it. That's the name of the game, okay? And one day, as well as putting the cash value in, we want to make sure that he changed the beneficiary
to the
perhaps
trust.
Right, mm-hmm. Instead of being a spouse, perhaps. If it's kids, it's a different story, but the idea is we want to protect as much value as possible. We're greedy like that. You're doing a trust to protect houses and all these other things. Might as well take advantage of every little aspect of that Medicaid trust. And, you know, we kind of were cut off at the very beginning. I assume he started by saying he's got a Medicaid trust because that's the whole point of doing what he was doing.
Yes, because he kept saying a grantor trust.
Yeah.
So as far as premiums and stuff like that go, it's a bill, right? You're paying a bill. So it's a bill that you would have to pay whether the policy was in the trust or not in the trust. So it's just an expense that you have. And you are adding value to the trust, but it's definitely not making it an available asset to
right.
pay for your care.
That's right. Well, thanks for that phone call. We'd love to have another one. And I would like to tell everyone about our seminar schedule, because even though we just did our seminars on wills versus trusts, we do have a wills versus trust seminar down at our Kingston location. That's going to be on Thursday, March 28th at 2 p.m. at the Courtyard by Marriott in Kingston, so about a month and change away. And also, we're going to be having a very special seminar just on aging in place, so the community Medicaid program, how to qualify, what kind of services you can get through Medicaid while not being in a nursing home. It's very important stuff. It's going to be March 21st, 2 p.m. at the Glenn Sanders Mansion. That's 1 Glenn Avenue in Scotia. And if you'd like a seat at one of those seminars, again, Wills versus Trust down in Kingston or Aging in Place up at the Glenn Sanders Mansion on March 21st, 518-465-7581, or you can email us at info@herzoglaw.com to reserve a seat there. Debbie, you know, we had these seminars on wills versus trusts, and I had lots of questions that I received about the difference between obviously wills and trusts, and we got really deep in depth. You know, well, what if I do this? What if I do that? Did you have any interesting questions or points that you were making while you were doing your seminar? Say, hey, you know what? I want to talk about this on the radio. Anything?
Well, I mean, if we go back to Eric,
yeah.
with our sample we were talking
sure.
about, if they had a trust. Right? If the uncle had put all of the assets in the trust and then he passed away, Eric would have never been notified. I mean, he would have known probably that his dad passed away, but he wouldn't have had to sign off on anything. So it wouldn't have given him an opportunity to come in court and contest the will. He would have had to bring the proceeding. And so it would have been his dime rather than the estate's dime to bring the proceeding.
Absolutely. You know, we have a lot of clients who... There are clients, and they did trust, perhaps, and they put things into the trust, a house, a brokerage account, what have you. And we still end up, when they pass away one day, still needing to do some work on an administration. Sometimes it's a small estate. Sometimes it's actually a full probate. And the difference between the two is what dollar amount is passing through their estate. And if it's 30 grand or more, it's going to be a full probate. And that too is avoidable. And that's almost the most tragic type of probate, because they came in, they set up a trust to protect assets, yes, but that trust also avoids probate, as you mentioned. Yet they don't update what's in the trust from time to time. They don't come in, they set it and forget it. They came in 2006, and the next time we see them is actually hearing from their kids because something happened. It's imperative that people come back in, review their plan, look at what's in the trust, update beneficiaries, and do all those things, because if we did a trust to help you avoid probate and to preserve assets, and then you end up going through probate, or you end up doing a crisis plan for Medicaid because we had so many assets outside the trust, it's tragic. It's a complete waste, because you spent good money to create documents to avoid those things, and then you didn't follow through on the steps that we outlined for you to do. And we can help you and remind you as long as you come in.
And that's why we tell people they should come in every 5 years and look at their documents, unless there's a crisis. A classic situation of that is, say you have a child that right now has a financial problem, right? So whenever you set up, or they're going to be going through a divorce.
Yep.
I've had that lately. A lot of people come in and go, My daughter's going to be going through a divorce. Can she be my trustee, or will her husband try to get the assets? And like, nope, she's your employee. You're good to go. But a lot of them will set up trusts so that it goes into a trust because they think it's like a double protection for their kids, right? If they have a financial problem or if they're going through a divorce, and then fast forward like 7 or 8 years later, and there's no financial problem and everything, and then the parent dies, and now it goes into trust for this child, and this child is like, hey, I want my money.
Right, there's no need for the trust anymore.
So
I got one better. I started smiling when you mentioned. So I had a client this week that had said, we anticipate that our son is going to get divorced. And I looked at the questioner. He's not married yet. I thought it was so funny, but they think that he's going to end up marrying the girl that he's been dating for a while, and she is a lot younger than he is. And they think that even if they got married in a number of years and she's, you know, in her mid-20s,
mm-hmm.
they anticipate it. And so they want language in their documents that anticipates something. Again, it blew my mind, but I was so happy that they're looking forward like that. I mean, you know, no names, obviously, but she's a wonderful girl, they say. But, and when it's about their inheritance that they're going to be leaving to their kid, they want to make sure that one day when they have grandkids,
mm-hmm.
right, that they want to make sure those grandkids are protected. Even if there's a very happy marriage, if God forbid their son passed away, they want money to grandkids. They don't want their daughter, possible future daughter-in-law, or their possible future grandkids to be in charge of the possible future money. So it's just very interesting. And, you know, you say 5 years. If big things happen in life, good or bad, come on in.
Yeah, definitely.
We're not going to send you a bill. Just come on in. Let's talk about it. Because a lot of times it's an easy fix. Let's put some more in. Let's take some stuff out of the trust. Let's adjust who your power of attorney is. For example, one of your kids moves out of town and they're across the country and they were your healthcare proxy because they were really local.
Mm-hmm.
Let's update that thing if you think that's appropriate.
Yeah, I had a situation this week where one of my clients called in and said that there was a situation with her son, who's also her trustee, and come to find out, she had written him a check for Christmas, a blank check, because they weren't really sure how much the gifting was, you know, whether it was, you know, $13,000, $15,000. So she kind of just signed a check and gave it to him and said, you know, when you figure out what it is, just write it for that. So instead of
that's trust,
instead
that's
of trust instead right of writing there. The check for $15,000, which is the amount allowed right now for gifting, he wrote it for $110,000.
Oh,
yeah. So then he went in and online and moved the money out of the savings into the checking, so the check would clear, and left his mother with a whopping $30,000.
How'd that work out?
Not so good. So
I would imagine. So
we've had to do some changes as far as the power of attorney, as far as the trustee. I mean, and that's the thing. It's like, you know, you don't ever expect your children to do something like this, but you've got to be very, very careful. I mean, writing someone a blank check is probably not a good idea.
I think that's the worst thing you could possibly do. I think. Unless it's addressed to Ben Patton.
Thank you.
Then it sounds just fine.
Yeah. And I would be good with it, of course.
Of course. Of course. So you've really got to be careful what you do, and you've really got to be careful who you appoint. And sometimes people will appoint co-trustees and co-powers of attorney. And I'm not necessarily advocating for that, but if you have any questions in the back of your mind as to the control that you want to have on things, if you name people as co, then they both have to sign off on everything.
Yes. And even more importantly, don't let what Debbie said to make you think, I don't need a power of attorney because I don't want to deal with that kind of power loss.
Mm-hmm.
You don't lose any power when you do a power of attorney. You're giving someone else authority to act. But you know what? We'll hold on to the originals because it's a just-in-case document.
Mm-hmm.
And no one can do anything because they don't have the original, right? We're holding on to it. And if something happens, we don't need to do a guardianship and we have your son or your daughter or so on. And someone could act for you. The problem with the blank check was, well, he could write any amount he wants. But that was, amplified by the fact that he had the ability to move money around to fund whatever money he wrote in. And have a good power of attorney and have your kid on it. And if you have one moment of caution, oh, I don't know if I want to have, then name somebody else. It's
right.
A just-in-case document to avoid guardianships, to help us continue the Medicaid plan in case you never did any of that stuff.
But it's something that you really, really need. I think that the power of attorney is the most important document that you can have. Because if you become ill and you end up in the hospital, they're going to look to your next of kin to make your healthcare decisions. If you pass away and you don't have a will, state of New York has already laid out where your money's going to go. But if you become incapacitated, there's nothing generic that's going to take care of that.
I tell people there's worse things than dying. And there is, obviously, I'm kind of exaggerating a little bit, but I'm less concerned about a client passing away than a client being completely incapacitated, because that's when there could be a lot of money that's wasted because of lost opportunities of planning and things like that. And it's really easy to just take care of it. I mean, it's the most simple documents that we do. We'd love to have another caller at 518-476-5900 or toll-free at 1-800-WROW-590. You know, Debbie, I have to thank you because you provided me with lots of hearts filled with chocolates that I gave out on Valentine's Day up at the Queensbury Hotel for our Wills versus Trust seminar. And every, you know, even though it was, you know, I'm sure it was just from, you know, a drugstore or something like that, the faces that I got back after I gave them this thing, right? Even if it was a single male individual in his 70s, he just saw this heart. He just couldn't help but smile. So thank you very much.
Those were little, there was like really good chocolate in there too. We have a caller. We have Bess from Gilderland. Good morning, Bess.
Good morning. I have a question about power of attorney, and I understand how important it is. My attorney's office holds the original copy. I have a copy. How is that started? How is it put into operation when it is needed? I know that my copy is unsigned, and then I understand that it has to be signed before it can be used. But what is the protocol for getting it in use?
So did you signed it? So when did you do your power of attorney?
Oh, several years ago already.
Like before 2009 or after 2009?
It's a current one, after 2009, yes.
Okay. So you signed it, and then the person you appointed, did they sign it?
No.
Okay. So it's in your attorney's vault, and it's unsigned by the person that you appointed.
Correct.
So in order for them to act, they would have to sign the power of attorney. So in a perfect world, if something happened to you, then they would call and say, hey, mom is incapacitated. I need to make decisions for her. What do I do? I was given your card and told to make a phone call. What do I do? And then they would contact the law firm, and then the law firm would, number one, make sure that there was a situation where they were actually supposed to act. And then if, in fact, there was a situation, then that person would have to come in and sign the power of attorney before they could act.
Okay, and it has to be the original from the attorney's office.
Right, they can't just sign a copy.
Can a power of attorney be pre-signed and ready to go?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think it should, to be honest with you, at least for
okay.
your primary agent.
All right, yeah. Okay. All right, that clarifies it for me. Thank you.
You're welcome. Have a great weekend.
Bye.
We'll be right back with the second half of the Herzog Law Firm's Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour right after this.
You've been listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. Join us every week to learn more about protecting the assets you've worked hard for, options available for Medicaid planning, and more. With offices located in Corporate Woods in Albany, West Harrison Street in Saratoga Springs, and Flatbush Road in Kingston, our attorneys are here to help you. If you'd like to schedule an appointment to speak with David, Jane Marie, Harry, or Debbie, please call us during normal business hours, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. To contact us at our Albany office, call 518-465-7581. Our Saratoga Springs office at 518-581-8131. Or our Kingston office at 845-338-6405. Let the Herzog Law Firm help you navigate a plan that works for you and your family. Now back to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
And we're back.
I'm Dave Kubikin.
I'm Debbie Fernie.
Debbie and I are two of the attorneys at the Herzog Law Firm. And if you were listening to the first half, you heard a phone call about a power of attorney. And I just want to touch on it real quick, Debbie, before we move on to our next caller. You know, our practice typically is to have the agent sign. And if they're not in the room when the principal signs, when our client is there to sign, we'll mail it out to them with instructions so they could sign it, have it notarized, and return it to us. And we may not do that for some of the backups because sometimes the power of attorney gets lost in the shuffle, and it's really important for that first person to sign. My fear always is that if the person who signs that power of attorney as agent does it after there's some change in the law or something like that, that maybe the power of attorney won't work. So me personally, out of an abundance of caution, I'd say to that attorney, please have my agent sign the power of attorney so you have a fully executed, at least for the principal and the agent.
Right, the number one.
Yeah,
the number one. You definitely need at least the number one person to have signed.
Yeah, I would. We did have another caller, Peggy and Wilton. Good morning, Peggy. How are you?
Good morning, Dave. How are you?
Good. What's up?
My question, I just got a little confused by a previous caller this morning who was asking about taking money out of a brokerage account that's in a trust, where I think you said that the trustees could write checks for dividends and interest only to him. But what if it's a house that's in an irrevocable trust and you want to take out funds from the principal, the equity in the home, for a roof, for a car, for things like that? Is that allowable in the irrevocable trust?
Well, that's a great question. So let me first talk about the first part of your question. So our trusts and most of the typical Medicaid trusts are going to have income be payable to the settlor, the grantor, the person who created the trust. So dividends and interest and things like that, that's going to be going to the client, right? And if they don't want to take it, they can reinvest it, and that's fine. They will be paying taxes on their individual tax return for whatever income is generated by the trust. Now, the second part of your question gets a little more complicated because you may go to a bank, for example, and say, well, this trust is in a irrevocable Medicaid trust, and you're not the trustee, and you can't access the equity that's in that trust. But we know that from time to time, people will want to access that equity, and they want to redo their kitchen or something like that. So there's a couple options, and depending on which local bank you go to, and I do recommend more local banks because they have more flexibility, I suppose. You can get, in most cases, a home equity line of credit, even though the trust is still owning the house. The trust that we do has a couple pages of language that says that you are the exclusive user of that house, right? You have exclusive use and occupancy of the house. It also says you're responsible for all the expenses of the house. So you should be able to access equity in the house, okay? If you ever have a problem with it, give our office a call. We'd love to explain how our trust works to the banker that you're dealing with to try to get some flexibility there. Now, you can also, if you wanted to, if it's a capital improvement that's going to increase the value of the house, you could use money that happens to be in the trust to do something like that. Now, we got to be careful because the terms of the trust say that you, the individual, not you, you know, someone who benefits from the trust, you, the individual, are responsible for the carrying costs of the house, taxes and things like that. But if there's a capital improvement, we can get a little more creative where if a bank's giving you a hard time, we can use assets that belong to the trust. And certainly you could always use your own assets outside the trust to do any of the things you're talking about. But if we're talking about accessing equity, that's going to involve a home equity line of credit or a second mortgage or something like that, you may run into a couple speed bumps along the way.
Okay.
But there are local banks that'll do a home equity loan for one of the trusts. So you can get a reverse mortgage. You can also get a home equity loan. The only thing you can't get on your property that's in a trust is you can't get a purchase money mortgage. So what that means is you can't refinance your house. A lot of people that put their houses in trust years and years ago when the rates were really, really high decided that when the rates dropped that they wanted to refinance their houses. And unfortunately, the only way to do that is to take the house out of the trust, refinance it, and put it back in, which starts the 5 years all over again.
Okay. Very good. That answered my question.
Great. Thanks so much for your phone call.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much.
And the next caller could be calling us at 518- 518-476-5900 or 1-800-WROW-590.
Debbie, I wanted to mention to people, so we don't operate in a vacuum, right? When we're doing estate planning for people, we're not just looking at one aspect of their life. We're kind of looking at everything. And when we're deciding what assets are going to go in, what assets are going to be kept out, because it's not about putting every asset in, I want to know, how do we plan on spending our lives? Are we going to be traveling a lot? Are we going to be using a lot of money? In which case, let's not put in money only to have to then do partial revocations to pull principal out. If we're anticipating that there's going to be changes to your home at some point, if we're anticipating that, you know what, maybe in a year or two, I am going to want to refinance, right? That is going to be a factor as to whether we put the house in now, we put the house in later, you get the loan now, you get the loan later, all that stuff. So it's really important that when you're, you know, I don't anticipate anyone's going to sit at home and listen to the radio and say, I need a Medicaid trust or anything like that. I anticipate that they're going to listen to us and ideally maybe go to a seminar, maybe call Stacy for an appointment, come in and go through their facts and our expertise and come up with a plan. You shouldn't be coming to some conclusion without considering all these other factors and all, you know, the tax implications for things. I can't tell you how many times we've found out from people that they've done transactions that will have a negative tax impact. And if they just called us, we could have planned it a little differently.
Exactly. And we have a caller. We have Linda from East Greenbush. Good morning, Linda.
Good morning.
How are you doing?
Good, thanks. How are you?
Good.
Good. I have a question about an irrevocable trust. I put my dad's home in my irrevocable trust a couple years ago. In December, I sold the home. What are the tax ramifications? Who pays the tax on or capital gain or anything?
So is dad still alive?
Yes.
Okay. And how long, what happened with the proceeds from the sale? Did you put it back into the trust?
I did.
Okay, very good. So because he had that life use of the property and he was responsible for the expenses, there's going to be a capital gains exemption that still applies to the sale. So if you never did a trust and you sold your house or he sold his house, the first $250,000 of gain, not sales price, but actually profit that he made on that sale would be exempt from capital gains as long as he used that house as his primary residence for two out of the last 5 years. Okay. So that capital gains exemption will continue even though the house has been in the trust because he had exclusive use of the house and he was responsible for the payment of all expenses.
Okay.
So as long as he didn't make as a profit over $250,000, or if you're a married couple, $500,000, there won't be any capital gains. It'll be as if he himself sold the house, even though the proceeds went to the trust.
Okay, but another question. My daughter is one of the trustees. I am not a trustee. I am the grantor, whatever you call it, of the. I set up the trust.
Right.
She told me yesterday she got some kind of, I don't know if it was a 1099 or some kind of tax form regarding the sale of the house. Why is she getting that? I haven't seen it. She hasn't given it to me yet, but what's that all about?
So you just mentioned that you were a grantor. Your dad should have been the grantor, right?
No, it's my family trust.
Oh, your family trust.
He signed his house over to my trust, the deed.
Oh, well, that changes everything.
What's that?
That changes everything.
Oh, okay.
Unfortunately.
It makes it more complicated, right?
So when did dad buy this house that he transferred to your trust?
When did he buy it?
Yeah, how much did he pay for it?
I don't know. He built it in 1957.
Uh-oh. Okay, so did he maintain any life use in the property?
Yes.
And so when he gave you the trust...
He was still living there.
Okay, and in the deed, did it say he gets to continue to live there?
Yes, he had a life estate and...
Okay.
Yeah.
So that means that some of the proceeds from the sale are going to be subject to capital gains and some of the proceeds from the sale will not because he retained a life estate. So if you picture a straight line going from left to right, okay... The way that he used to own his house was now until the end of time. Okay, and when he did that deed to your trust, he split up now until the end of time into now until he passes away. And then that moment until the end of time. So he kept his life estate, which is during his life, and there's actuarial tables that can say how long that typically will be.
Mm-hmm.
And then your trust owns it from that moment on. And when we're selling a house, right, that deed probably had his signature on it as the life tenant and had the trustee's signature, your daughter's signature on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can actually, and the IRS can actually apportion the proceeds to partly being belonging to you or the trust and partly belonging back to dad, even if all the money went into the trust. So that's why that 1099 is coming, and you really need to meet with an accountant to kind of figure out what the tax implications are going to be of that 1099.
Okay. But my daughter won't have any, will she?
Well, she's a trustee, right? So she won't have any obligation, but it's possible that the trust will have an obligation.
Okay, that's fine. She was concerned about her own obligation, and it's like, oh, that's really a mess. I wouldn't want
to. She just happens to be trustee, that's all.
Yeah, she's just an employee.
Yeah.
So she doesn't have any liability whatsoever, but what you would have to do is go to a CPA, and they would figure out what dad originally spent on the house plus any improvements would be his basis. And so then they're going to take that, and then whatever his basis above the amount that you sold the house for above his basis would probably, less his life estate, is going to be what capital gains are going to have to be paid on.
Okay. All right. It is complicated.
It is. It's definitely get a good CPA accounting firm to do it, because it shouldn't be a huge amount of money, but you definitely want to make sure that it's done right.
Well, as long as my daughter's not liable for any of it, that was my number one. There's plenty of money in the trust to cover any taxes. I just don't want it to be put on her.
No. She's fine.
I will tell her that and reassure her. Thank you.
No problem. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thanks.
And we have another caller. We have Jack from Glenmont. Good morning, Jack.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. In the first half of the show, you were talking about having a trust. I have a trust with you and still having to go to probate. And I didn't hear the whole thing, but I wonder what could I have done or what might I do that would trigger probate in spite of my trust?
So the trust governs only the assets that are in the trust. So what we want people to do is we want them to be aware of what is not in the trust. So let's say you have a bank account, a checking account in your name. Well, I want that account to avoid probate because it's not in the trust right now. You could avoid probate by having another name on it. So it's a spouse or a child with rights of survivorship. You can perhaps have it transfer on death or pay on death, TOD or POD to somebody. You could do that type of thing. Otherwise, that account, if it just had your name on it, that's going to be subject to an estate administration, and based on the total amount that's subject to estate administration, we may have a small estate or a full-fledged probate. So the name of the game is you knowing what is in the trust and what's not in the trust, how things are owned, and whether or not there's any beneficiaries or transfer on death instructions.
So as far as I can tell, I only have a checking account with my daughter on, and I think it may be a DOT. I'd have to check that, but I think it is. Where would you see that anyway?
Sometimes they have it on the statement. If not, next time you go into the bank, just ask them to check the signature card.
Okay.
It's probably, you know, transfer on death or in trust for, but as long as you have a beneficiary on something, or it's joint, or it's in the trust, there won't be any probate. Probate is only assets that are individually in your name when you pass away.
Okay, so the only thing I would have would be the car.
Right. And they can transfer one car without going through probate.
Okay. So I'm in the clear.
You're in the clear.
Okay.
Well, you make sure, check everything, because just because you think that everything's where it is, you know, you should make sure.
Right. Okay, very good. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, bye.
I had clients come in, brother and sister, and dad had a trust with us. Mom was already gone. Dad had a trust with us. He had moved all the assets into the trust, and I'm looking at everything, and I said, what about the MetLife stock? And they went, what MetLife stock? And I said, yeah, he had MetLife stock. So what happened was whenever the life insurance companies demutualized and they issued stock, a lot of people don't realize that they have stock from one of the insurance companies. And they're just getting these dividends every year, and they cash the checks, and they're like, this is cool. I'm getting a return on premium and everything. And then the person passes away, and we have to probate the estate to get 10
just
shares of MetLife stock.
That's
classic. It's classic. I mean, I would say probably everyone does everything perfectly, and then it's some stupid little stock like that that ends up throwing them into probate.
Like I said, it's a necessary evil, which means that it's necessary and it's evil, and you want to avoid it if you can. The previous caller to Jack, though, that's the type of stuff that we were kind of talking about. Because when they decided they're going to sell the house in the trust that Dad has a life estate on, well, you know, if Dad passed away one day, still having that life estate, all those capital gains would have gone away. There would have been a full step up in basis because he had maintained that life use. But when he sold it during his life, now we're splitting up the proceeds. And it's little things like that where we really want people, you know, especially if you're one of our clients, when we're thinking of selling trust assets, when we're thinking about moving to another state, when we're thinking about changing things up a little bit, you really need to just touch base with us, or I highly recommend it because we may have some good advice for you. We did have a Medicaid client, a community Medicaid client, and it was really interesting because mom had lived in a house similar to what our previous caller had, where husband had kind of built the house, mm-hmm. It was, you know, for peanuts. House is worth a lot more now because, you know, life changes. And she went to another attorney, or her daughters went to another attorney, and they deeded the house from mom to three daughters without maintaining a life estate for mom. And so what ends up happening in terms of tax situation is these children receive the tax situation mom had. So if they ever sell the house, they're going to have capital gains. And unlike mom, they didn't live there for two out of the last 5 years. And so they will lose that capital gains exemption. And the reason why they were told to do this is because mom's not going to live in the house anymore. She's going to live with one of the kids. What we would have done, and then they decided, to sell the house after right. these transfers. So there's going to be huge capital gains ramifications to it. So we talked to an accountant. We confirmed that we can move the house back to mom. She will still qualify for capital gains exemption because technically she was two out of the last 5 years mm-hmm. in the home. They can sell the home with no tax ramifications, no negative tax ramifications. Mom will continue to live with daughter. Okay. We threw that money that came from the sale into a trust. She qualifies for community Medicaid in her daughter's house. Perfection. It was great. You got to know the tax implications.
You do. And now we have Joan from East Greenbush. Good morning, Joan.
Good morning. I'm just starting the whole process. I have a adult child that has health issues. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be starting the Medicaid trust process. He is older, and we just want to make sure we have a secure environment for him when we pass. Where do you think we should start?
Well, that's an excellent question. I think that probably the best thing to do would be to sit down with an attorney and go through everything to see exactly how your assets are held, what kind of health problems this person has, and what kind of care they're going to need in the future. Generally, whenever we sit down with clients, we have them fill out, our prospective clients, we have them fill out a client questionnaire, and we go through everything. And we ask them, you know, how are these assets held? What kind of situation are you looking for in the future should something happen to you to take care of this child? And kind of go from there. There's really no cookie cutter answer for your question. It's looking at everything and making sure, kind of like when you go to the doctor and they give you a diagnosis as to what you need to do. Whenever we meet with clients, we're giving them a diagnosis of what we think their estate planning should look like. So okay. I think that that's what you really need to do.
The good news is you're being really proactive. And you know, so your options can include, for example, just having a basic will, but having language that creates a supplemental or special needs trust. For him, mm-hmm. you could create a standalone trust that has similar language. The difference between the two is, well, I'm sure you have life insurance and other assets where you name beneficiaries, and you could actually name the newly created trust for him as a beneficiary on things. So you could actually create a trust and not even put anything in it today, but point things to it, because I know you have beneficiaries on other accounts and on retirement and things like that. So you can get money to be governed by these rules. You got to do something, because we want to make sure if he's able to qualify for federal benefits because of his disability or anything going on like that, that he continues to get it, notwithstanding the fact that he just received an inheritance. And if we plan it the right way, that inheritance isn't going to ruin those benefits.
Yes, because he's currently on Social Security disability and Medicaid.
Exactly.
So in addition to that, I have a daughter who's much older than he is, and we anticipate her in charge of everything when we do pass.
So the way that she's going to be in charge for sure is because you're going to have documents that say she is going to be in charge. And whether it's a will with really great language in it or a standalone special needs trust, or you're starting the plan for your long-term care and you leave things upon the termination of that Medicaid trust, partly to your daughter, partly to him, in trust, right? You'll then have to manipulate your beneficiary designations and how you own things so that way we could take advantage of it. What sometimes happens is that people will create a really good will or a really good trust, okay? And then they'll have some assets that, like a life insurance policy, that still names your son and your daughter as a beneficiary, which means that the money he gets won't be subject to those beautiful rules that you put together. So we really want to make sure the plan all makes sense. And when Debbie said you should meet with an attorney, it wasn't because, like, you don't know the answer. It's because it's a very complicated answer based on all the facts and circumstances that you're dealing with.
And on the average, how much does this cost?
Well, you know, it could range from, you know, $600, $700, $800, $900, because we're doing a will package and lots of language in your will, to, you know, several thousand dollars because you're doing either standalone trust or a Medicaid trust with extras all over the place. What we would do, and what we would do really with any client, is when you come in, we'll let you know based on our discussion with you and the facts and all the your wishes and desires and fears. We'll come up with what the plan is, and we'll quote you a couple different options on that plan, and you could then have a fixed fee that you move forward with.
Well, thank you very much.
All right.
Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. You know, great questions.
Absolutely. A bunch of great. I don't know what it is, but a lot of questions today, and they've all been fantastic and all, you know, kind of related, touching on different things. We have a tremendous amount of clients who somewhere in the family, whether it's a grandchild or a child, where they're worried about some special needs and they want language in there. We have clients that, you know, have beneficiaries who aren't doing so well, substance abuse, gambling problems. We have language in our trust that take care of it, right? We could do really anything you want.
Well, it's their documents. I mean, that's, people need to understand that we can custom make them for whatever they want. And that's why we offer the free consult. People can come in and sit down with us and figure out exactly what they need, because some people don't know what they need. And a lot of times we can put trigger language in there that says, if my child is on, if they're on disability or something like that at the time of my death, then it goes into a trust. But if they're not, then it doesn't.
Absolutely. If you do want one of those complimentary consultations, you can give us a call at 518-465-7581 in the office, and Stacy can set you up with an appointment in one of our three offices, whether it's Saratoga, Kingston, or Albany. We do home appointments as well. And Debbie, Jane Marie, myself, Harry, one's better than the other, and we're all very well informed. Another way to get more information is coming to one of our seminars, and we do have a seminar at the end of March down in Kingston. That's March 28th. It's a Thursday at 2 p.m. at the Courtyard by Marriott in Kingston, 500 Frank Sotal Boulevard, right next to Target. That's a fun one for me. And then also in March in the Capital District, we're going to have a special seminar specifically on aging in place, community Medicaid, the topic that we're normally talking about. I'm so happy we're not talking about it today, just because there's so many other topics in estate planning that we you know, kind of gloss over at times. This special seminar on aging in place is going to be March 21st, 2 p.m. at the Glenn Sanders Mansion, 1 Glenn Avenue in Scotia. And same deal, you can get a seat there with a call at 518-465-7581 or an email at info@herzoglaw.com. If you or a family member or a friend, a coworker who's constantly going home and checking on mom, it's a great seminar for them to go to.
And they could go on our website.
Oh, yeah.
www.herzoglaw.com and look at all the different seminars, because we've got them come up in April, too. We kind of gave ourselves a break for March. So we have the two in March, one in Kingston and one at Glenn Sanders. But other than that, we have four seminars that are coming up in April. And if you go on our website, at, again, www.herzoglaw.com, you can look and see when these seminars are and when we're going to be there.
Absolutely. You know, I wanted to also bring up one issue that came up at one of the seminars and then resulted in a consult. So a client that has a revocable trust, and we were talking about avoiding probate and how a revocable trust can do that at the beginning of the hour. People tend to get older every day, and at some point that revocable trust, even though it might be beautiful, will need to address your long-term care needs. A lot of people hear, you know, trust, and they don't know the difference between the two, just like they're not sure what probate is. And they hear, well, you're the income beneficiary on a Medicaid trust, and you're responsible for all your home expenses with a Medicaid trust. And they think, oh, well, I have a Medicaid trust, but you know what? You have a revocable trust. And that revocable trust doesn't actually protect any of your assets. So if you're sitting there and you say, well, I know I got this whole probate thing down, and I'm going to avoid probate because I have a trust, what kind of trust do you have? Is that going to address your Medicaid needs or your long-term care needs? We're so concerned about who gets what. We also want to make sure that those people that are important to you get as much money as possible. And at some point, the natural progression is to go from will to revocable trust to Medicaid trust. And there are a lot of people out there that only have a revocable trust, and you got to look into a Medicaid trust.
Yeah, if you're going to protect assets. And a lot of people are like, well, I have long-term care insurance. I don't need an irrevocable trust.
You may be right.
If you only have $100 a day of coverage, You probably still need an irrevocable trust.
Absolutely. And the topic for our April seminars, even though I know it's, I want to think about April just because it's not going to be
sunny.
Snowy. But that's going to be our most general seminar, which we get a lot of attendance for because it covers everything from powers of attorney and healthcare proxies, like we discussed today, all the way through the Medicaid trust, aging in place, and all that stuff. It's great.
Well, it encompasses everything.
Yeah.
It's not specific, so it's kind of general view. So have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you next weekend.
Thank you for listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. For more information on their services, please visit herzoglaw.com. If you'd like to speak with one of their attorneys, please contact the Albany office at 518-465-7581, the Saratoga office at 518-581-8131, or their Kingston office at 845-338-6405.